Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we've actually got five different stories we'll cover, just a little bit short on each one. We'll talk about Big Five Sporting Goods as they provide an update on their earnings. Things Remembered reportedly filing for bankruptcy soon. We'll talk about Shopko once again as they try to divest their pharmacy division. And finally, we'll talk a little Google Express. But first on the show, we'll discuss jewelry retail, something we don't discuss often on the show. Quick reminder before we delve into that to like us or rate us however you do find us. And as always, don't be afraid to reach out to us on Twitter or via email or on Instagram at Retail Podcast. So back to that retail sector we don't discuss very often. Signet Jewelers announces several store closures in an aftermath of a tepid holiday season. You know, Signet is the largest global retailer when it comes to diamond jewelry in particular in the company. Although you may not recognize the name Signet, if you've heard of Zales, Jared, K Jewelers, among other known names, they're all part of that same banner. And they actually bought online jewelry retailer James Allen for $328 million in 2017. But really, besides trying to grow their online retailing presence, the biggest piece of news over the last decade, Leighton, was kind of a settlement between the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that alleged one of its subsidiaries signed customers up for credit services that they weren't privy to, something that kind of resembles Wells Fargo and what they did at massive scale, ended up having to pay $11 million in penalties and fees to settle in 2018. Outside of that, the company's had a pretty low profile until this. Now they're deciding to close several stores.
Yeah, so it's been sort of some ups and downs, if you will, for Signet Jewelers. And what's interesting is they sort of do have a firm grasp on the United States market for jewelry and for diamond jewelry in particular. We don't, again, talk about this a lot on the podcast. We don't talk about Signet. We don't talk about their competitors. But because they do have such a firm grasp on the jewelry market, we don't often either think about consolidation or expansion either in the market. It's sort of just steady as you go for retailers such as Signet Jewelers, but you look particularly with their strongest brands as of late, just not as strong as they once were. However, much of their presence still exists in older malls. So you would think that, well, maybe they are still drawing some customers, the customers that are still going to those older conventional malls that were built in the 70s and 80s. They're still sort of a staple in those areas, some of which, by the way, are still struggling to keep traffic up despite the strong holiday season. But you know what, Trent? Rents are coming down just a little bit. But still, despite being able to have a little bit of negotiating power with those landlords of those conventional malls, you still see some troubles at the bottom line for Signet Jewelers. As it relates to brick and mortar traffic during the holiday shopping season, we're going to beat that drum again. It was very solid. It was very strong throughout a number of different sectors, including jewelry. But guess what? Not as strong as it was in the overall landscape. So if you extrapolate some of those retailing figures from the last couple of months, you could see that there was around a 5 to 5.5% increase in retail spend. And that is a big, significant portion of consumer income. If you think about last year and the year before, those were also record figures for a number of retailers. What's interesting is jewelry came in around 3.8% up over last year. So you think 3.8%, still a good figure, but still less, again, than the overall basket of retail goods. And after already having signaled several store closings earlier this year, the retailer has made it known that they will speed up closings in 2019. So again, probably looking at those conventional malls to close a few stores, but Signet, a publicly traded company that is part of the S&P 400 index, trading under, by the way, ticker SIG, recently released their holiday season sales report on their investor relations webpage, and it was not the prettiest one. And not only were the sales figures a little bit subpar, guidance for fiscal 2019, Trent, was also soft. But back to those holiday sales, and this is why we're talking about this, is for the holiday season sales report. You see that same-store sales were down 1.3%. Again, looking at competition, looking at their competitors, somewhat of a different niche, but a lot of their competitors were either neutral or positive on the back of that 3.8% increase for jewelry. They also revised fourth quarter guidance to same-store sales down 1.6%, down 2.5%, GAAP earnings per share between $2.32 and $2.53 per share, and non-GAAP earnings per share of $3.77 to around $3.92 per share. They also revised fiscal 2019 guidance to same-store sales approximately flat. So they're looking forward to 2019, basically saying to the public, it's going to be more of the same. And Trent, executive comments from the executive team weren't that solid either.
No, they weren't. And in fact, their CEO, Virginia Drossos, commented that their holiday season performance, she felt, fell short of their expectations. And that honestly, early on in the quarter, they felt like they had improvements in refreshed merchandise assortment and digital marketing. But those were all offset by larger than expected declines in some of their legacy product lines. So kind of a theme there. Layton was talking about some of their standing in older malls. Well, it's those legacy malls that are struggling, but it's also the legacy's product lines here for Signet Jewelers that are struggling. And they mentioned competitive promotional environment, also churning prices downward, and mentioned that their own promotional investments didn't produce the traffic that they wanted. They experienced reduced traffic, in fact, during December gifting weeks. And you combine all of that with what she mentioned is higher than expected credit costs, kind of a perfect storm that led to a negative outcome here for Signet. And as we take just a small bit of time to look into the most recent sales trend, we note several things to take into consideration when looking at Signet's business moving forward. First, within their key holiday sales figures, there was more aggressive advertising. Some of that promotional activity, promotional investments, not only with price with the company, but also with advertising and more target marketing than in their previous year. Management said quite clearly in their prepared remarks here that the response had a positive underlying impact on sales and their efforts paid off. One hesitates to think what sales might have looked like had they not done any of this marketing or additional marketing here during the sales season. Of course, holiday sales season, so important to jewelers and so important to marketing for jewelers in the first place. But again, more spend, they were able to bring more traffic in, but it was more than offset by other negative trends. And so their overall traffic was down. Now, second, their financing initiatives, which include leasing plans and payment plan implementation, that was strong. These plans, like other credit cards we've talked about with Progressive Leasing, for example, are designed to be easier for customers, less invasive, and to ensure the sales of goods and services now, to try and get them to sign on the bottom line now rather than at a later date. So these things are good, but there are plenty of other things that kind of indicate negativity here for Signet, especially with all of these successful marketing campaigns, with these successful leasing techniques and that type of thing to consumers. The bottom line is sales didn't come in where they were expecting.
No, and they were still down, which is going to be a problem for those shareholders because they are, after all, a publicly traded company. The microscope is on them and what they've been doing lately. You can tell the public all that you want that your marketing campaigns are successful and all of your new leasing programs, all of your new financing programs are successful. But guess what they're looking at? They're looking at top line revenue. So it really doesn't matter at the end of the day. You have to execute on what you promised. And guess what? Seeing that guidance for fiscal 2019, that is not a good look for a company that is already in a lot of trouble, including in the areas in which they've operated in for quite some time. You're talking about a staple in the industry, one that's been around for decades, now having a ton of problems. And on top of that, Trent, e-commerce sales in the holiday season were $223 million, or just under $223 million, up around 5.6% year over year. One could say that's a positive. You're talking about an increase in sales for e-commerce. However, that was after that massive acquisition, one. Two, this is on top of a retail environment that is seeing double-digit increases at some of the most stagnant retailers here in the United States. You're talking about Best Buy never really reporting anything below double digits. Same for Walmart, same for Target, same for even Costco now reporting 20 to 30% increases, and they barely have an online platform. So you really have to take a step back and say, you know what, 5.6% when all of jewelry sales for the holiday period were up 3.8% again in the United States. That is a problem. They need to continue building out a robust e-commerce division before pulling off anything else in terms of marketing effort. And this overall does not bode well for the company heading into 2019. This is our take because we get the broader sense of why management teams may not be the most optimistic in the months ahead. We really need to see management up their optimism with the company. They need to really tell their consumer, they need to tell their investor, they need to tell everybody, including their operational teams that are at the ground level, what they're going to do to right this ship. So we really have to ask ourselves here what the company is going to do to improve their balance sheet. If their current operations are not providing the same rate of return they once did, what is the underlying problem? What are the consumers wanting that you're not giving them? Signet CEO again said in a statement that the company will move decisively to improve profitability through aggressively optimizing their cost structure and continuing to right-size their store base. But that tells us very little. What that tells us, and the reason that we're talking about this, is that they're going to be closing more stores. But what are you going to do with those existing stores? Those company personnel, they want to know what you're going to be doing. What is your strategy moving forward? You can't just say that you're cutting costs because then you're the next Sears. And Sears, guess what? It did not turn out too well for them. And honestly, currently, the company has smaller cost savings plans in the works. Nothing that substantial in our humble opinion. We were looking at the balance sheets earlier, not that aggressive in terms of cost cutting. If you're talking cost cutting on an annual basis, $30 to $50 million, yet you're the largest in terms of market share diamond jeweler in the United States, something is wrong with your strategy. The company now operates nearly 3,500 stores. This was as of the 1st of January this year. The big question for us is where we would ultimately see some sort of larger scale consolidation, because while they're hinting at closing stores throughout the country, where exactly are they going to be doing that? Are they going to be doing it in metropolitan areas, or are they going to be doing it in those regional malls that have fell by the wayside? While still profitable, the company is staying ahead with their issuance of a quarterly dividend. Again, another flashing red signal to us, at least, because Signet's board of directors declared a quarterly cash dividend, a pretty large one, 37 cents per share for the fourth quarter, really keeping on track. So while their share price is far, far down from where it used to be just a few years ago, they're keeping steady with that dividend. Now you see that dividend rate, Trent, around 6%. Speaking of those shares, again, ticker SIG, prices are close to a 9-year low, hovering right around the $25 mark as of Friday of last week. They were at $54 this time last year. So again, you can keep issuing that dividend all you want, but those long-term investors should be really fixated on what the company is going to do to return value for the long term, the next 5-10 years, not the next few months.
So we go from kind of the negative in Signet to the positive in Big Five Sporting Goods as they announced their fourth quarter earnings update and full year update with modest late year gains. And by late year gains, we primarily mean December, because even as late in the year as October and early November, the company was still tracking negative, but a sharp turnaround in the latter part of the year that management says has continued on into January has us arching our eyebrows at a sporting goods chain that looked to be kind of right now in the moment where Hibbett Sports was a year ago, kind of struggling with sales. Hibbett had a better 2018, but we'll see where Big Five ends up in 2019. Now, these late year gains are particularly important considering the poor fiscal year Big Five had displayed up to November and December. To compare, Big Five is basically, like I said, now where Hibbett Sports was back in 2017 when you compare the numbers. And there's more to compare here than just the numbers year over year. As with Hibbett, Big Five operates in a number of smaller markets, but also has stores in larger metro areas based out of California. Many Big Five stores are freestanding, usually in the neighborhood of around 8,000 to 12,000 square feet. Most of their 436 stores are in the western U.S., but they do have outposts as far east as Texas and Oklahoma. So primarily we're talking about a West Coast chain. Hibbett, when you think Hibbett, you think largely Midwest, you think largely smaller towns. Big Five cuts their teeth in a lot of smaller to mid-sized markets as well. Now let's talk about this quarter. Their preliminary results dovetail with traditional calendar quarters. So just to let you know, this quarter concluded December 30th. 2018. We'll get full results at some point in February, but this was basically just an update or those preliminary results. And for the quarter, this is the big news here. Big Five came through with a 1.1% improvement in same-store sales over the same period in 2017. And you might be saying, well, 1.1%, that doesn't sound like a big number when a lot of businesses are producing 2, 3, 4%, or in the case of Costco and some others, 7 to 10%. But for Big Five, you have to put it in perspective here. You have to understand Big Five has been negative mid-single digits for most of the year. So to turn around with a 1.1% improvement for the quarter over the same period in 2017 is rather remarkable for them. Net sales for the company were also up slightly. So not just same-store sales, net sales as well, from $242.9 million up to $247.1 million. Now, the increase in net sales, primarily due to that same-store sales increase, although they did add one store to their portfolio during 2018. Now, when we talk about a favorable comparison with the rest of the year, a same-store increase, as I mentioned already, of any kind is amazing. After same-store sales losses of, get this, 7.5% in the first quarter and losses then of 2.1% in the second quarter, third quarter was still slightly better, but down 2.0%. So this is what I mentioned when I talk about that 1.1%, even though compared to other retailers, maybe not so robust. This company, this very same company, had negative same-store sales of 7.5% back last winter. And so this is going to be an interesting thing going into the first quarter here, going against very poor comps from 2018. Can they continue that momentum in 2019? In a likelihood, they should be able to, again, given those poor sales. But as a result of the poor early showings for the full year, same-store sales were down 2.7%. But even better, when you look at the fourth quarter, we always talk about this, Leighton, it came from a combination of average ticket and traffic. So both of those were up slightly. If one of those were up, we might not take it so seriously here, but both were up, and that we look at as representing a more sustainable sales increase, because if the increase was just ticket, so ticket sizes going up but not traffic, or the other way around, if traffic was up but ticket not, it can indicate one-time impacts from things like clearance events, new product releases also, because we're talking about the sporting goods industry, a new shoe that comes out, a new popular type of piece of baseball equipment, for example, that could present a little boost here, but less sustainability long-term for the numbers. And I think the fact that both ticket and traffic up for Big Five shows positive things. And although the company said it was partially because of the weather, it's not just because of the weather. And they had other good news, despite the fact that traffic was up and sales were up, other good news in other areas in terms of the company's bottom line.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about weather in just a little bit. But Big Five Sporting Goods, we've talked about it before. We've talked about this company before on the podcast. This is a company that I am now more intimately familiarized with because I live in Orange County, and there are probably a dozen Big Five Sporting Goods, not only in Orange County, but also up north in Los Angeles County. This is a retailer that I'm extremely surprised to see the amount of traffic that it's coming in. In all of these different types of stores here, the Big Five Sporting Goods model is not that streamlined. So one store could be entirely different from the next. It's fascinating what kind of a presence they have out here and what kind of really nice real estate that they are actually involved in as well. Some really nice end caps alongside these shopping centers. Very beautiful, well-kept stores. Again, a lot of traffic so far, anecdotally, that I've seen coming into Big Five Sporting Goods. But that other good news that you touched on, Trent, came from inventory reduction. In this case, Big Five was struggling to move product, and as a result, they saw inventory levels balloon above where they perceived as optimal. However, by the fourth quarter end, they decreased inventory levels by 7% versus the conclusion of 2017, suggesting that their initiatives to move out stale inventory and better anticipate consumer demand were bearing fruit. Again, drawing back to my real life experience over the past month and a half or so, seeing hordes of people go in and shop there at Big Five Sporting Goods. But all of this had a slightly positive impact on their new bottom line expectations for when they release their full earnings report in February. They now expect diluted earnings per share to come in around at a loss of 15 to 17 cents per share. However, much better. We talk about a loss being a bad thing always, but their previous guidance was much worse. It was between negative 15 cents per share to negative 25 cents per share. So they really shored up the long end of that guidance. And for the full year, by the way, they expect losses per share to hover around 8 to 10 cents per share. Again, better than their previous guidance. So you have to take that for what it is. But as we transition here back to the weather, the idea that weather can either be a good or a bad thing for a company, we try to not place undue credit or blame on weather all that often. We are wary of placing undue credit or blame on weather. CEO Stephen G. Miller noted that the cold weather has thus far been a credit to their sales. He mentioned that this has not only provided a positive impact for the company and the sales in December, but that this really has momentum, at least to this point, that's carried over into this month of January. In fact, the decently cold December month contributed to mid-single-digit same-store sales increases. This pushed quarterly same-store sales positive after mild losses in October and November. So that is really good news for the company. And credit, by the way, to Miller and the company for giving the weather its due rather than crediting internal sources as the sole reasons for the turnaround. A lot of companies would love to take credit by saying that they executed well on their marketing strategy and that's why sales are up, but they really are fairly realistic about what's happened and how external events can really have an impact on the company. He seems to be very realistic about his business's current status too, and acknowledges that they have a ways to go in terms of making profitability. And speaking of that road towards profitability, Big Five has been able to pay down some debt recently, which is always a good sign for a company. They were able to use some strong fourth quarter sales to pay down approximately $19 million in debt, leaving with them just $65 million in debt at the end of the quarter. While this isn't perfect for a company of this size, the amount of debt is more reasonable and their efforts to continue to eliminate it should make them more efficient in turning sales into profit in the near future.
Generally, now we could see potential for a better 2019. Not going to see massive growth here. I think you're not going to see unit growth, certainly in the neighborhood that Big Five has had in the past, maybe a decade ago, but they've stabilized their store base. They haven't overexpanded lately, at least. And they know their target markets. They're very familiar with the West and the Mountain West that they operate in. This combination should likely keep them afloat in the wake of all the struggling sporting goods retailers shuttering in 2016 and 2017, the likes of Bob's Sports and Sports Authority. You know, these companies, Big Five, Hibbett, they've managed to stabilize somewhat over the last couple of years. And with those two and then Dick's, which is a much larger market sporting goods retailer, you have to think that brick and mortar sporting goods probably here to stay, especially since, and we've mentioned this on the podcast before, Amazon just has not made much of a foray into the sporting goods realm. Their selection is still relatively poor. And Leighton, you and I both active, we both purchase our fair share of sporting goods. Very, very difficult to find good pieces of equipment on Amazon compared to the likes of e-commerce sites, even for the likes of Dick's and Hibbett. But ultimately, it's going to come down to a lot of times people just want to try gear on before you buy, and where and when that's possible. That's why those brick and mortar stores may end up continuing to, if not win out necessarily, certainly survive going into the future. Well, speaking of survival or the lack thereof, Things Remembered, a mall staple, will reportedly file for bankruptcy soon, potentially closing most of their store fleet. Now, often we feel as though e-commerce gets blamed unfairly for the bankruptcies or closures of retailers. We feel as though some of the e-commerce notations have been a little bit exaggerated. For example, I saw an article on Reuters the other day that blamed e-commerce for Sears' downfall, and I think those of us that cover retail know that might have played a very small part, but Sears was already well on its way into the tank before e-commerce became, you know, truly a phenomenon in the United States. But in this case, with Things Remembered, e-commerce may be legitimately to blame. Now, Things Remembered was founded in 1967, is pretty much held almost always onto niche retail categories surrounding gifts and engraving and personalizations. Now, they do still have several hundred brick-and-mortar stores, many of which on the West Coast, actually a lot of kiosk-based stores as well in malls. They also do business in Canada with a handful of spread-out locations. They're a privately owned company, around 400 locations left in its portfolio. And as we kind of mentioned, you know, they cut their teeth on personalization, but sites like Etsy are absolutely crushing that market currently. Anytime you have a consortium of creators that can personalize and do so at a relatively reasonable price, a retailer like Things Remembered is going to take a hit. And Things Remembered honestly had multiple things working against it in recent years. First, they've got a significant profile in many B and C class malls. We talked earlier in the show. These are the malls that are not seeing the traffic stability of the A-class malls right now. And we'll be the first to tell you, you know, malls are not dying. Malls are not going away. A lot of the A-class malls are seeing a lot of success. At the same time, B and C-class malls, which you may have heard, are not exactly traffic positive. The status in A-class malls, not enough to save sales here for Things Remembered. Second, you know, there are troublesome confluence between offering personalized items, but they're doing so in the form of a massive chain. And this is basically in an area of retail where bespoke handmade products from smaller suppliers have taken up a massive amount of market share. Like I said, Etsy, they're not the only ones, but Etsy is the most notable one where you're bringing together a number of producers that can make these products and make them perhaps a little bit more meaningful. And that's one of the other issues for Things Remembered, is that Etsy exists. Let's be honest, if Things Remembered becomes extinct, we can probably credit or blame, depending on how you're looking at things, Etsy for playing a major role in this. Basically, any online site that offers personalization really chipping away at Things Remembered. And fourth, let's face it, like the store name, Things Remembered, that's not good. They almost deserve to fail on this point alone. I've never liked that particular store name. And in this case, we may not have to look at it for too much longer.
Yeah, that's right. It may be a distant memory if all goes poorly for the company during bankruptcy. Again, it's not official that they're going to file bankruptcy, but reports suggest that if bankruptcy does happen, if they do file officially for bankruptcy, it's going to pretty much spell doom for the company, as initial plans are calling for the closure of the majority of their stores, again, around 400 stores. Along with those 400 stores, Trent, you always have to factor in the employees, or at least we do on this podcast. Anytime we talk about retail closures, a lot of people love negativity. A lot of people love hearing that retail is dead or malls are dying. Guess what? That affects employees directly. So for them, about 2,500 workers, the impending liquidation sales will divide digital assets from those in its brick and mortar stores. So you're trying to see them extract the value where they can. But again, to what Trent alluded to, not a lot of brand equity, at least in our opinion. Only an auction for their assets will really truly decide the value that they bring to the table for the American public. But the hope for creditors, at least, or all involved, including the part owner, which is KKR, by the way, is that their e-commerce division does have some value and that their remaining brand name and presence is actually worth something to someone out there, although it's a little bit unclear to us as to what that would be worth. And the company, like others that have been filing bankruptcy as of late, or at least over the past year and a half or so, actually went through a somewhat recent debt restructuring back in 2016. What's interesting, think about Toys R Us, constant debt restructuring, and that's it. What really ended up tanking their business was those monthly debt obligations, those quarterly debt obligations. Trying to repay all of that debt became a huge burden for that company, and it's no different here with this particular story. You see that this company seemed to have had made very little changes over the past year or two since they restructured that debt in 2016. How they did business, pretty much just the same. And as we discussed, they've been facing new entrants online that are far better at creative designs and engraving optionality. And guess what? Shipping happens far quicker nowadays. So while it has been a little slow in terms of e-commerce adoption for things like engraving and customization services, they can get the product done far quicker now thanks to 3D modeling and different ways of printing the item, and then they're able to ship it off and get it to you within 24 hours. So it's really a no-brainer if you're into that sort of thing. If you're into that niche retail category, they are up against some fierce competition right now. And Things Remembered, according to some simple arithmetic, have close to around 55 stores closed over the past year already, have, again, not really restructured a whole lot in terms of their current store operations. Not only has the company been trying to manage over that $120 million in debt that they've been faced with, they have a slew of high executive turnover over the last 3 years. And so again, those 55 store closures, it's not going to really do a lot for the bottom line. The problem is within the actual organization. Those making the leadership decisions are not doing their job, or at least not doing it correctly. Changes include a new CMO and a new CEO after the previous CEO stepped down. But many of the remaining stores are in nicer areas, you could say, that demand high rents, which could also be an issue for the retailer moving forward. So you're talking about a massive liquidation of almost all of their stores. And this really gets us to scratching our heads, because is there not maybe a handful of stores that are overperforming relative to the rest of their store base and areas that they could at least afford the rents? But it appears as though there is just not a lot of demand, or at least as far as we can tell, a lot of demand for what they sell. And I think it's not just lease rates. I think if you look at the broader problem with their store concept, and I think it really goes back to their roots several decades ago, but the idea that their stores are larger and they need to have more presentation space for their special gifts that they bring in, their seasonal items as well. Take a look at some of the older stores online if you get a chance. If you get a second out there, there are some images that would totally take you back, because this is in 2018, 2019. Some of these stores are massive, and yet they have just a huge amount of sales floor space with very little product. And by the way, their countertops, their glass tables, very antiquated. It looks like you're stepping into a store in the late 80s, if I'm being honest. And so I think there is sort of an inherent problem with how dated some of the stores are. And anytime you have over 50% of your available floor space that's just green carpet, it's probably not a good look. Again, a lot of older designs not really playing in to the customer that's excited about buying small creative gifts for their loved ones. And again, even for the tourist type visitor, there's a store here near where I live in Santa Monica, not that nice. So guess what? The customers are going to go to the newer shopping centers with the newer competitors, either that or go online.
And last to this story is in regards to their partnership with Amazon that was announced last summer, perhaps an instance of too little too late. They would begin selling items in their own Amazon store. However, it seems as though never really that made that much of an overall impact. Again, too little too late, but also they were kind of late to the party, where those seeking that personalization were going to other outlets online. And because it never really made an overall impact, could never really spurn enough cash to help them out in any meaningful capacity. And we took a look at their Amazon page shortly after the announcement, and many of the items simply don't compete on price and don't elicit a lot of reviews. If you've listened to the podcast in the past, you've probably heard us talk about this. 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes a day. They're hungry for knowledge, they continuously seek self-improvement, and they want to learn every chance they get. And our partner Blinkist gets you there faster than you can imagine. Look, if you're like me, the list of books you want to read or the list of books that people suggest I read, that's never ending, always expanding, it piles up. And I don't have time to read them all, neither do you, but our sponsor Blinkist has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all.
With Blinkist, it's the only app that takes thousands of best-selling nonfiction books, distills them down to the most impactful moments, so you can read or listen to them in just under 15 minutes, all from your phone. And with Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere, and personally, I do listen anywhere. I listen on my way to work because my commute is a little bit longer now here in Orange County. And then also, I listen to it at work because my new job is fairly mindless.
Now, the Blinkist library is massive. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. You have timeless classics, or we say timeless classics because it seems like they're timeless, like Freakonomics, to current Amazon bestsellers like Influence, a book there that's distilled down to just 18 minutes. So pretty remarkable. My personal recommendation, The 80-20 Principle, that's a great book, as well as Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. Really enjoy that one. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your 7-day free trial. Easy enough to remember. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. That's Blinkist.com/retail.
Back with the news portion of our show, and it is going to be a small story because we've talked about this company at a length over the past 2 months now. Shopko is back in the news, and as we've talked about numerous times now, with store closures and a new bankruptcy notice for the company, they've auctioned off now 120 pharmacy location assets, and this is what this story is going to be about. Again, a little nice short story because we're trying to follow up here and stay relevant with the goings-on with this particular case, but purchased by Sun Capital Partners, a private equity firm, of course, for about $1.1 billion back in 2005, Shopko operated around 363 stores in 24 states under several different formats. We've talked about their hometown format, and we've talked about the format that used to compete with the likes of Target, a little bit bigger of a store there. But combined with previous closure plans, the company is shutting down nearly 100 stores now. So around 38 stores was their initial plan, now close to around 98, I believe, many of which, by the way, are hometown formats. They are relocating 20 optical centers to freestanding buildings and are looking to restructure other parts of their organization as well, although a lot of insight can't really be found as far as the details there. But Shopko actually has deeper pharmacy roots than one would think. And this is something that we've talked about at length before, and that they should have really focused on their pharmacy division, because guess what? Pharmaceuticals, they're here to stay. And it's extremely lucrative for general merchandise retailers to have a pharmacy division. I don't care who you are. You could be Kroger, you could be Walmart, Target, any of these companies. It behooves them to have a strong, well-branded pharmacy division, but they just weren't able to execute. But I say that they have deep roots in the pharmacy division because they were actually founded by a pharmacist in 1962. So he was intimately aware of how to operate a pharmacy. Back to now, back to 2019, this comes as Walgreens actually secured a deal at the end of last year to procure 185 pharmacies from Fred's Pharmacy. So Fred's is going to still operate the retail side of things. Everything else, all of their pharmaceutical division, is going to be farmed out, Walgreens among other operators. And that's relevant. This is really relevant because you see, the time is now for large operators, and this is what this story is really about, in that there's going to be consolidation within this market, and it's not for lack of growth. It's growing rapidly. The estimates for pharmaceutical growth between now and 2030, phenomenal, absolutely incredible. So Walgreens, between Fred's and Rite Aid, has been on a massive buying spree. CVS as well. Think about reaping all of the rewards from buying out Target's pharmacy division a couple years ago. So Trent, consolidation and competition to buy up regional pharmaceutical operations has been a real driving force for some of the biggest retail pharmacy players in the United States. We've talked about that. Knowing how the prescription drug market is going to outpace general economic growth, it's there in the figures. It's definitely there in the figures during every single earnings report from CVS and Walgreens. You see that they're trying to capture market share now, where they have the hopes of being the prevailing brand in whatever area they're looking to buy in terms of these Shopko locations.
It really is a case of buying low, not so much that there's low perceived value to the pharmacy divisions for companies like Fred's and Shopko, but the fact that these companies are desperate, and they know, Shopko and Fred's do, that there is a finite amount of buyers that are out there for their pharmacy assets. And so that aggressive willingness combined between CVS and Walgreens to take over in all parts of the U.S. was more apparent than ever during Shopko's auction, where there was demand from express stores and in-store pharmacies there. According to the U.S. Bankruptcy Court filing, more than 20 bidders trying to secure Shopko assets. Now, not just pharmaceutical assets, of course, but 20 bidders trying to secure Shopko assets. A lot of players in this particular bankruptcy court filing, not just CVS, Walgreens, and the likes of those. Now, this tells us not only is it imperative to capture new or existing markets, but that Shopko's ability to successfully operate was poor. When you have 20 people, now granted, some of them probably liquidators, but when you have 20 companies lined up for your assets, that tells you that a lot of people in the retail space didn't think you were operationally sound. Now, among the winning bidders are, of course, the big three, Walgreens, CVS, and Rite Aid. They're essentially purchase agreements here that need final approvals across the board, but the total dollar amount is over $50 million, and Shopko says all funds will, of course, go to the debtors per the bankruptcy requirements. Now, Walgreens was not only one of the three winning bidders, but they were by far the largest. They purchased rights for 63 Shopko pharmacy locations. In a statement, Walgreens said they were excited to welcome new patients to their business. Of course they are. Oddly enough, Albertsons and Kroger also won out, along with some smaller regional grocers, because a lot of times you have Shopkos operating in smaller towns. You have smaller regional grocers scattered in these markets that could really see an opportunity there to kind of snatch up some market share. And in a free market type situation such as this, certainly obvious that there is more opportunity to succeed than to fail. So many interested parties looking at even the smallest of market sizes. You really have to think about the sheer size of the transactional value of all of this going forward. So once again, wanted to follow up on this. Interesting goings on here as the pharmacy assets get kind of auctioned off to the highest bidders. But again, we'll see what becomes of the Shopko bankruptcy if Shopko can maintain those freestanding locations, or if other assets end up going to bankruptcy auction, who snatches those up as well? Well, on to our final story with Google Express, as they look to be under pressure as Walmart has decided to pull their items out of the platform. Now, introduced 6 years ago, and something we don't talk about a lot on the podcast, Google Express was designed to be a one-stop shop for online shoppers who liked shopping through multiple retailers, kind of an online shopping mall of sorts, if you will. Now, the largest retailers in North America slowly started to get on board with the platform, where the promise of Google's analytical prowess could, in theory, better direct customers to the items they were searching for or recently searching for. We all know about that search history strength there. The idea being here that customers could save time from shopping their different favorite retailers' websites and just go to one website to peruse items based on price and compare across the board. It's kind of a clearinghouse similar to Amazon, where there are subscription tools for commonly used items. You can also deselect certain retailers that you want to exclude from a search. So if you didn't want to, say, search at Walmart, you could deselect them. Google Voice is also tied into the system, so you can call out shopping commands. Google's website uses olive oil as kind of an example there to explain your process. Now, with Google Express, if you're unfamiliar with it, you do have to create an account, presumably so they can, of course, track your purchase history, just like they're tracking everything else. However, no annual fee, so different in that regard from Amazon Prime. In order to receive perks like free shipping over a certain dollar amount, usually if you spend between $25 and $35, you're going to capture free shipping there. Several retailers, Layton, currently involved in the program. You've got Target, Costco, Best Buy, and PetSmart. Formerly Walmart, among others, but now Walmart no longer there, and some rumblings about issues with the platform.
That's right. And I think I can speak as a former customer of Google Express, thanks to a few promo codes, that it is sort of an up-and-coming platform. And we say it's been around for 6 years. It's 6 years of development, really, because it is constantly evolving. And one thing that I don't like off the top, Trent, you mentioned $25 to $35 is the threshold for free shipping. I would like to get to a platform and actually know what mark going into it I can hit in order to achieve free shipping. I don't want to have to go through different retailers and buy different items to maybe hit different thresholds along the way. Consistency is the key to having an online brand. We've said it time and time again, and Google Express still hasn't figured that out, which is interesting because they have probably the most data of any retailer or any company that interfaces with retailers on planet Earth. So the retailers that we do want to get to here are very involved with the program, and they're extremely large as well. We're talking Target, Costco, Best Buy, and PetSmart, among others. Around 20 well-known retailers use the platform. Departments are fairly broad, and mobile shopping is seemingly much more tedious, though, than Amazon. Some people complain, too. If you look online, look at some blog posts out there. I know, again, there's a lot of negativity, and the last thing we want to do on this podcast is be negative, but they do apparently have a lack of selection and therefore a lack of functional search tools. To me, it was oversimplified. I like to be able to at least do a few things to narrow my search down, but I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they haven't partnered with a lot of retailers. And a lot of this, and what we'll get into here, is the fact that a lot of retailers are a little tepid as to offer their full product assortment on the platform, and for good reason. In addition, some products are not supported in two-day delivery, and most don't have same-day delivery. Again, consistency. You can't have one retailer giving you a seven-day lead time on the same exact product that's offered by another retailer at the same exact price point that has a two-day lead time. It makes no sense, but that is what you'll occasionally find on Google Express. In an era where people are expecting more faster service and really not waiting for the packages to come to your door, they're not standing up to the competition. This is an era where a lot of companies are aggressively investing to get their omni-channel initiatives going, to get things delivered to their stores instantly, to bring things to your doors within 2 hours in some cases. Furthermore, if we think about Target's own omni-channel initiatives, some aspects of the Google Express partnership leave you thinking that the coming together only makes sense for Google for that particular partnership now, and that program is slow to evolve, and it could almost devalue Target's own reinvestment, which is in the multi-millions of dollars, and their brand's messaging as of late, especially during the last holiday season, where they really prided themselves on the fact that they rolled out almost every single initiative they had in the pipeline back in the spring in time for the holiday season before November hit. So I think, honestly, if you're Target and you're selling on the Google Express platform and they don't have the optionality that you have on your website day to day, it is going to be a problem long term for your brand, because people come to know something and then they go onto a different platform with your logo, they're going to expect the same thing. Again, consistency. So drawing off of our own experiences and again, those of others, it stands to reason that Walmart most likely wanted to weigh the pros and cons after 2 years into this partnership with Google Express. And while Walmart has arguably been better at buying online-only operations, we think of Moose Jaws being one. Several others have been very successful for them that they've closed on in the past year. They've still been making strides in their conventional Walmart.com operations. We think of things like grocery pickup, grocery delivery. The perception of their overall online service has been getting better too, according to management's words, at least from some studies that they've released to the public. But their most recent analysis must have come back negative in our view, or at least not well enough to keep the program going, as Walmart last week ended officially their partnership with Google Express, and Google Express officially ended their partnership with Walmart as they officially took off Walmart from their retailer list. But many of Walmart's products were known brands, Trent, for instance, from Procter & Gamble and others. And so it was unclear exactly how many items were featured from Walmart in total. But in relation to their entire store selection, or at least their entire online selection from Walmart.com, it was markedly less than what was there. And even if you're discounting all of the products on Walmart.com that were from third-party vendors, it's still just a drop in the bucket from what they had displayed on Google Express.
Now, this, again, is part of a potentially bigger issue, or maybe a bigger wave for Google Express here. Online news source Digiday points out that adopters early on, like American Eagle, Staples, Lucky, Office Depot, Blue, and the outdoors retailer, REI, they're also no longer selling products on Google Express. So potentially, like I've mentioned, maybe indicative of problems with the platform, or as Layton said, you're kind of confounding branding by using the platform in some cases. But in the end, analysts think it could go one of two ways as a result of this very recent Walmart pullback. One, Andy Taylor, who's an associate director of research at Merkle, said that Walmart's exit is probably disappointing, but might offer opportunities for other brands. The prevailing idea that smaller retailers wouldn't previously want to have too many products on Google Express because of Walmart's potentially lower price point on the most common items that could show in a particular search was something that kind of bandied about in the analyst realm, and this is logical. But the big question is, if Google were wanting to attract all sizes of merchants going forward for their platform, they're more directly competing with Amazon again, just with a less functional platform. Now, if Google wants to make it viable for the long term, probably need to create real value for the customer, something we talk about all the time for all retailers, by offering better shipping, A, and B, reaching out to retailers consistently, prodding them to get more selection on there. Otherwise, it may very well be another Google markdown similar to their long-running social media platform that was shut down in October in Google+. Long live Google+.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
What brings us to the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I talk about a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year, and we start with Leighton.
My looking ahead has to do with a story, or at least a survey, brought to you by CompareCards.com. In that report, it says during the 2018 holiday season, Americans applied for store credit cards at the rate of around 30%. So 30% of shoppers applied for a store-specific credit card over that shopping season. And what's curious to me is that there wasn't a lot of data as far as what happened in 2016 and 2017. So you can't really put this report in perspective, but a couple things stood out to me, and this is why it's my looking ahead. You tend to think of younger individuals, millennials in particular, ages maybe 20 to 35, as making less money, having less income than the older demographic, especially those that are nearing retirement age. And maybe some people who even are drawing pensions have more income than you would see in an average millennial. Well, those millennials ages 22, the survey says, to 29 were the largest demographic to actually apply and receive store credit cards. It says they were also more likely to get rejected too, probably because of that income equation. But overall, you're seeing that these younger people are okay with credit cards. And this was something that is actually contrary to what we've heard in the past, where people are saying that younger people that are in this particular range actually went through parts of the Great Recession. And so they're going to be a little adverse to pulling a credit card and using the credit card for purchases that you don't actually need, things like apparel and gift ideas. So this really brings to mind the idea that in the long term, we're talking 1, 2, 5 years from now, are they going to be purchasing less items because they're going to be having to pay this debt off at some point in time? And what's interesting to me too, along in that same vein, it says via this survey at CompareCards.com that the interest rate of a lot of these branded store cards, around 25%. The whole reason they're issuing the cards is not only the top line revenue, but the fees and the interest rates. Think of all of that as almost a cash bundle for them during the rest of the year as people are paying back this debt. So I think for me, it's going to be interesting to see, looking ahead to the next holiday season, are we going to see the same trend in terms of the percent of individuals that are applying for credit cards and the percent of individuals that are actually using the credit cards? Or are they going to put their foot on the brake a little bit because they're having to pay that 25% interest rate from the purchases they made last year? So I think that's a big reason why we have to keep an eye on this particular story. And I think you have to pay attention to all of the consumer debt and how willy-nilly people go about trying to apply for these types of leasing programs and cash upfront programs, where I think in the long run, it may actually hurt your personal balance sheet.
So from very large and general to very specific, my looking ahead story has to do with an article that came out in the Dallas Morning News. Fantastic retail writer Maria Halkias came out with this particular article saying that Neiman Marcus actually reinvesting in off-price. Now, we talked about Neiman Marcus a few episodes ago saying that this is kind of a make-or-break year for them because, again, they're trying to return to profitability. They've been losing money of late. So that's kind of where they're at, and they're doing so by adding 4,000 items to their online last call store. So once again, we talk about outlet presence and that type of thing. We've seen some brands like Restoration Hardware go away from that, But Neiman Marcus jumping back into it, and not just in a brick and mortar sense, but adding 4,000 furniture and home goods items to its Last Call website, which is at lastcall.com. So essentially, this is after Neiman Marcus closed down a dozen Last Call locations back in 2017. They're kind of bringing that back, maybe realizing that, hey, this is perhaps a pathway to profitability. Now, no word on expansion in brick and mortar just yet, but the reason I'm looking at it is because Neiman Marcus took such a big step back. They closed down 13 Last Call stores overall over the span of a couple of years, and ultimately, you wonder if, you know, this online experience will actually push them to potentially open more Last Call stores in the future. Once again, outlet shopping is proving a crucial key for a number of retailers there. But there are a lot of retailers that are kind of taking a second look back at it and saying, hey, is it watering down our brand? Certainly something that Neiman Marcus kind of felt when they were closing down some of these stores back in 2017. So as with anything with Neiman Marcus, just in terms of trying to restore themselves to profitability, I want to see if this works, but also I want to see if this parlays itself into potentially adding some of those brick and mortar outlets in the future. So that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. I'll be coming at you from the Detroit metro area for next week's podcast. Layton will still be in SoCal.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.